Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. 50 years ago, David Bowie released his third album, The Man Who Sold the World. He made a name for himself the previous year with his big single, Space Oddity. Unfortunately, the LP, The Man Who Sold the World, didn't have a Space Oddity on it, and David Bowie was starting to look like he might be a one-hit wonder. Yeah, some people actually thought that about David Bowie. So at the beginning of 1971, Bowie went on a promotional tour across the U.S., reimagined in the new movie Stardust. On the tour, a young Bowie fumbles interviews and struggles to convince music journalists of his legitimacy as a songwriter. This is pre-Ziggy Stardust Bowie, still assembling his artistic identity and also grappling with his half-brother's schizophrenia diagnosis and what that might mean for him. The movie stars actor and musician Johnny Flynn as Bowie and Marc Maron as his American record label publicist Rob Oberman, who may have overpromised what he could deliver. Here's a clip featuring the two of them soon after Bowie has landed in America.
Tony said Mercury had doubts about the record.
Yeah, well.
But that he persuaded them to throw a lot of resources behind the tour.
Uh-huh. Well, managers say a lot of things, don't they? Look, the label gave me very little money. But I think we can make it work.
Look, I don't want to appear ungrateful.
Labels got doubts, you know, that's all.
Clearly.
But I don't.
You dying?
No. I think you're going to be the biggest goddamn star in America. Seriously, man, this is a great record. It's a great record. It's just no one knows how to sell you in America, right? They just don't care enough, you know?
And you do.
Hell yeah, I do. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a minority of one, but all it takes is one believer to change the world, right? And we got two.
Two?
You believe in yourself, don't you?
Stardust would have had its world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival before plans changed, obviously. So now we're featuring it as part of our series Tribeca-ish, taking a moment to recognize those films that were meant to screen at Tribeca this year. Joining us now is its director and writer, Gabriel Range. Gabriel, welcome.
Hi, Allison. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So this movie takes place in 1971. What did you want to capture about that time in the music industry and about David Bowie?
Well, I guess, you know, everyone has this kind of, everyone has their own sense of who David is. You know, David Bowie means something different, I think, for everyone. You know, for some people, he's Ziggy Stardust or Thin White Duke or Aladdin Sane, or, you know, he's Bowie of the Berlin years, like Sound and Vision, or of the 80s, you know, Let's Dance and China Girl. And I guess all of those different sort of, you know, so much of his brilliance as an artist was tied up in that sort of constant reinvention and all those incredible characters. And I think you can trace all of them back to this one chapter of his life when our film is set. You know, he, in 1971, he was not a star. You know, he'd had one hit single, which was Space Oddity, that a lot of people had dismissed as a sort of novelty record. And you know, 16 sort of singles that just bombed, that sort of sank without a trace. And so I think it's really easy to, when you think about an artist like David Bowie, it's easy to forget that there was a time when things were not all that easy, when things were tough, when he was starting out. And it was really just trying to sort of dig around in that period of his life, which I guess sort of felt like a lesser known chapter.
When you were casting this movie, what were you looking for in the actor who would play someone as iconic as David Bowie?
Well, it was much more important to me to find just someone with that kind of charisma and musical talent than it was to find, you know, someone with a sort of physical resemblance to mm-hmm. David. And Johnny Flynn, I was a sort of huge fan of Johnny as a musician and as an actor. And it was just really clear that he could connect with that sort of experience of what it is to start out as an artist, you know, stepping out on stage with that sort of level of uncertainty at that point in his career.
Now, the movie opens with the disclaimer, what follows is mostly fiction. What does mostly mean as you're writing it?
Well, I mean, it is founded very much in fact. You know, David did go to America in 1971. He basically, through a series of blunders by his management, didn't have the musicians' union paperwork or a visa that would allow him to actually perform the songs that he was out there to promote. And, you know, he was met at the airport that first night by this Mercury publicist, Ron Oberman, and his mum. so that all of the sort of, you know, the key points in the movie are all factual, but very little has been written about that trip that he made. And so, of course, you know, we've had to imagine all of the conversations, and, you know, we've taken some license with some of the characterization. But I think it is very much true to the spirit of where David was at in 71.
My guest is Gabriel Rains. The name of his film is Stardust. He wrote and directed it. A big part of the movie focuses on David's half-brother, Terry Burns, who was institutionalized after a series of episodes. What does Terry represent to David in this story and in his life?
Terry was his half-brother. He was 10 years older than him, and they were incredibly close. You know, in the mid-60s, Terry basically gave David his sort of musical education. You know, he took him to gigs, they bought records together. And then when David was 20, Terry had this sort of mental breakdown. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia and tragically sent to an asylum in southeast London called Cane Hill. And that had a huge impact on David, not least because three of his aunts had already been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so I think David had a real fear that that could happen to him also. You know, I think, and that fear is very much present on The Man Who Sold the World. You know, so many of those songs, I mean, All the Mad Men, which was a single that he came to America to promote, it's very much there. But in the whole album, that sort of fear of mental illness is very present.
In the film, there are moments that we don't see on screen, which I suppose we have to use our imagination. I'm thinking of the scene where David meets Andy Warhol, and we see we see him walk in, and then we see a little montage, and then we see him leaving. What goes into a decision like that, to not include someone as prominent as Andy Warhol in the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is some Super 8 footage that was shot while David visited the factory. And so we chose to just include our version of that. I think when you get into, you know, Andy Warhol's and, you know, I don't know. It kind of felt like it was better to sort of take what David took from that meeting, which was actually a kind of bitter disappointment, you know, because Warhol was a sort of real hero for David. And famously, Warhol, supposedly the only thing he said to David was, "I like your shoes," or rather, "You have nice shoes."
So I'm curious about what conversations you had with David Bowie's family or estate about seeking rights to the songs or to the story.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is we didn't. I'd be thrilled for them to see the film, and we had hoped, obviously, for them to be able to see it, you know, at Tribeca. You know, this film is not a biopic. You know, it's about a very brief moment in David's life, and a time in which he was, you know, really trying to figure out his identity as a performer. And so, you know, we didn't sort of need the music in that sense, because the intention wasn't to do a kind of spin through his greatest hits, you know, in the sort of style of Rocket Man or Bohemian Rhapsody. So yeah, I think, it, you know, the intention was really a sort of love letter to just an extraordinary artist at the beginning of his career.
In the movie, David's first wife is, she's a big part in the movie, and she's sort of like a pseudo-manager for him, and one reviewer even compared her to Lady Macbeth. What did you want to show about their relationship during this moment?
Yeah, I mean, Angie, David famously described her years later as like living with a human blowtorch, which might be a little harsh. But I think in this time, Angie really was his stalwart. You know, she was, you know, very ambitious for him and very protective of him. And so, yeah, we just wanted to kind of delve into that creative relationship. And Jenna Malone, who plays Angie, I think, did an incredible job.
We see David as, of course, by the way, my guest is Gabriel Range, director and writer of the film Stardust. We see David Bowie going into, as he's going across country, these interviews, and he's sort of blowing it. But my question is, I'm wondering, from your research, was he intentionally blowing it, or was he just naive about the way the music industry worked, from your research?
Well, I think what is evident in accounts of that trip is that even though he could sing about mental illness, which he did on The Man Who Sold the World, he found it very difficult to talk about. And so mm-hmm. when people would ask him, what is this album about? He'd kind of say anything but mental illness. You know, he famously said that it was about drugs when it clearly isn't. It was, you know, he so it was really trying to articulate that difficulty David had in facing up to what the album was really about.
As I mentioned in the intro, this is the pre-Ziggy Stardust David Bowie. How did this trip help create Ziggy Stardust?
Well, I think it was a really exciting trip for David in that he, you know, I think a lot of the influences that he would meld into Ziggy, you know, he picked up on that trip. You know, he heard the legendary Stardust Cowboys for the first time. On a second trip he made to the States that same year, he met Iggy Pop for the first time. And, you know, he went to a Velvets gig, you know, and you know, Lou Reed was absolutely one of his heroes. And again, I think those were really significant sort of meetings in his creative process.
Now, the film was supposed to premiere at Tribeca, as we mentioned. What's happening with it now?
Well, instead of the Tribeca premiere, we had a sort of virtual premiere for industry, for press and industry, which was a new experience. myself and Johnny Flynn and Mark Maron and Jenna Malone did a sort of an intro via Zoom for everyone, and then buyers tuned in from, you know, buyers and press tuned in from across five continents. So it was kind of mind-blowing, but certainly very different to what we'd imagined, which was, of course, sitting down with an audience at the VEC on Friday night of the first weekend of Tribeca to watch it.
Well, Gabriel Range, congratulations on the film. I hope it finds distribution. Gabriel Range is the director and writer of Stardust. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Harrison. Thanks for watching.